Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an expert speaks with us about the primary objectives of the climate talks. Pope Francis makes a visit to a mosque in Central African Republic. An author takes us to the source waters of the Amur River.
Where the formative Genghis Khan grew up, learnt to fend for himself, to guard for his family, and also where he learnt deep lessons in loyalty.
And we'll take a look at the music of Kate Davis, coming up right here on The Voice of America. Some 150 world leaders, philanthropists, and global investors gathered in Paris today to launch a two-week effort to forge international agreement on ways to halt rising temperatures and reduce carbon outputs from fossil fuels, believed responsible for extreme weather conditions. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Warnings from climate scientists, calls for action by activists, a new partnership forged between the United States and China, and major advances in clean energy technology are all giving impetus to the drive for progress among nearly 200 nations involved in the negotiations after the failure to reach consensus 6 years ago in Copenhagen. Ken Baldwin is a professor and director of the Energy Change Institute at the Australian National University. He explained to me the primary objectives of the 12 days of talks.
I think the goals of the Paris meeting are to, for the very first time, obtain an international agreement on the path forward to keeping global warming to below 2 degrees. Whether this creates binding targets is another question, but the important issue is that all countries agree that this is a goal that we have to achieve.
This is going to be costly?
It will certainly cost money, but that will pale into insignificance compared to the cost of doing nothing about climate change. If we allow business as usual to continue, the reports such as the Stern Review all show that the economic cost of the damage due to a high degree of global warming is significantly greater than the cost involved in mitigating the effects of greater CO2 emissions.
How do you expect these nations that are gathering to achieve their objectives?
The way in which this could be achieved is through nations to agree to, first of all, commit to their INDCs, their determined contributions, that will at least set national goals for reducing emissions on a time frame for the next decade or two. But more importantly, there should be a commitment to continually revise these targets in order to ensure that the world is on trajectory to achieve a reduction in emissions by, let's say, 2050. That will mean that we will keep global warming to below 2 degrees centigrade.
Is the technology keeping up with these hopes?
Certainly. This is a completely feasible prospect that we could reach the point by 2050, at which time global emissions have been reduced to such a level that a 2 degree future is, or less, is certainly guaranteed. The question is whether the nations of the world have the willpower or indeed the commitment to undertake the reductions that are needed.
Of course, there was a gathering somewhat like this some 6 years ago in Copenhagen, which fell short of expectations. Is there a possibility this will do the same?
There is a possibility that will happen. However, I would suggest that a number of things have changed during that time. Firstly, there has been an increasing awareness of the long-term disastrous economic effects of dangerous climate change. There have been greater realizations of the problems associated with pollution in general. And the other issue that has changed the landscape is that major countries, particularly the US and China, have taken leadership on the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in the lead up to the Paris conference, which has set the scene for other countries to rally behind them and to make a much more unified approach this time round compared to Copenhagen, where there was very little leadership in the lead up to the Copenhagen conference.
The Reuters news agency is reporting that the world's 48 poorest countries will need to find some $1 trillion U.S. dollars between 2020 and 2030 to achieve their plans to tackle climate change. Will the goals set out by this meeting put an undue burden on these poorest nations?
Certainly there has to be some burden sharing across the international community. That is a subject for discussion and negotiation at the Paris conference, and the aim would be to ensure that the major emitters and indeed the historically largest contributors to the current carbon dioxide burden in the atmosphere, i.e. the developed countries, that they take on a higher proportion of the burden in order to assist the emitters who will contribute the rest of the CO2 burden in the atmosphere in coming years to change and adapt their economies in a way that keeps global warming to below 2 degrees C.
Microsoft founder and world philanthropist Bill Gates joined President Obama and other world leaders today in unveiling a public-private sector plan called Mission Innovation to help bring down the cost of clean energy for poorer countries. Ironically, as the climate change summit got underway, China's capital, Beijing, was blanketed by some of the worst smog of the year, with the air quality index soaring to above 500, far above the level of pollutants where people are advised to stay indoors. The Xinhua News Agency says more than 200 expressway toll gates in eastern Shandong province were closed because of the smog. The province remains under a yellow alert, with visibility dropping to just 200 meters. As winter conditions set in, many coal-fired plants are pressed to meet heating demands.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
With a look at what's being said on social media about all this is our social media reporter, Olin Akisholu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, the big topic on social media related to the climate talks is actually the demonstrations that took place in major cities yesterday. The hashtag people started using to tweet about the climate protests was hashtag climate march, and more than 100,000 people included the hashtag in their tweets just in the past day. That's according to Topsy. And because the climate protests started trending, Twitter actually made it one of its moments.
What is moments, and what made it onto the climate march moment?
So Moments is a feature that the social media site introduced a few months ago, and it helps organize popular tweets on trending events for the climate march movement. If you scroll down, you see photos and video taken at different marches all around the world, a lot of them taken on cell phones. One environmentalist, Bill McKibben, he even tweeted a photo showing people gathered on a boat near Antarctica holding a sign that says, "We are on thin ice, act now." But looking at all the photos, it's striking how many people in different places got together to protest yesterday.
Any other interesting social media trends?
Yes. Well, another big trend right now is Japan. That's because the country's fisheries agency announced it will launch a new scientific whaling expedition in December. The International Court of Justice previously ruled that the Japanese expeditions were unscientific and should cease back in 2014. Across social media, the response has been pretty negative. Some people are encouraging others to boycott Japanese-made products, but many social media users have had a negative attitude to Japan's whaling practices in the past, so the reaction and the attention is not too surprising.
Well, thank you, Olin.
You bet, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA has taken an important step in completing construction of the James Webb Space Telescope it hopes to launch in 2018. Recently, engineers and technicians at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland used a robotic arm to successfully install the first of the new space telescope's 18 flight mirrors. NASA says that the mirror segments are made of an ultralight material called beryllium and is coated with a thin layer of gold. Once the pieces are installed sometime early next year, they will work together as one 6.5-meter mirror. The mirror, along with other state-of-the-art technologies that have been developed for the new space telescope, will allow scientists to study the first stars and galaxies created after the Big Bang and will play an important role in searching for possible life on distant exoplanets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Pope Francis, on the final day of his historic trip to Africa today, visited a mosque in the capital of Central African Republic, referring to Muslims and Christians as brothers and sisters who should shun hatred and violence. The Pope said, "Those who claim to believe in God must also be men and women of peace." Francis also met with Muslim leaders in an effort to promote reconciliation in a country torn by sectarian violence for nearly 3 years. After visits to Kenya and Uganda, the final Let the Papal Journey in Bangui was viewed as the most dangerous, requiring extra security. Pim Valkenburg, a religious and culture professor at Catholic University of America in Washington, says, While an unusual effort at outreach, it is not unprecedented for a Roman Catholic Church leader.
It's certainly unusual in the sense that there is little precedent for it. I think Pope John Paul II was the first to visit the mosque, and then Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis has followed his example. But what is, of course, most significant is that he is going to a mosque in what can be described as kind of a territory in which it might not be very safe for Christians to be.
We asked how successful the Pope's message of peace has been.
You cannot measure the success of a Pope's message in a political sense, in the sense that, okay, so many people obey his commands or whatever. I think his wish is more a long-term wish, and I think that his actions could be seen more at a symbolical level. In a similar way in which he tried to bring together, I think it's 2 years ago, the Palestinian president and the Israeli president to pray together for peace. Of course, that did not immediately establish peace, but I think Pope Francis is quite aware that his task as a religious leader is somewhat different from the task of a political leader. And in that sense, you could not expect immediate changes. It is more, I think, the kind of example that he wants to give. And in that sense, I think that his actions are very significant.
Valkenburg says the Pope's effort at reconciliation with Islam is aimed at creating conditions among peoples of both faiths to find common ground to create a more peaceful environment. Coming up on International Edition, an author shares his exciting adventure on the Amur River and the pleasant sound of a new singer-songwriter. We recently brought you our conversation with Dominic Ziegler, expert on Asia with The Economist and author of the book Black Dragon River, A Journey Down the Amur River at the Borderlands of Empires. Today we continue our chat by noting his extensive writing about Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan was born as the son of a sort of kind of small-time aristocratic nomadic leader. When he was young, his father died, and with his father's death, all the clan's authority went. His mother and his brothers and himself were outcast, and they were cast out by other nomadic groups, pretty much where the Amur River now rises. The source of the Amur is not called the Amur; it's called the Onon River, and that rises much to both Russia's and China's disappointment. In neither country, but in Mongolia, and the source waters the source waters which I reached by horseback with some Mongolian friends were really where the formative Genghis Khan grew up, learnt to fend for himself, to guard for his family, and also where he learnt deep lessons in loyalty, which were to stand him proud later on. It was there that he kind of gathered the clans, all the nomadic groups in Mongolia and in these mountains, and from there spread out in the end to encompass an empire that has not been matched on land ever since. It spread from China right through to Eastern Europe.
Well, this adventure of yours in this region, just how difficult was the terrain you traveled through?
Well, I'm not a great horse rider. So that was probably the most uncomfortable bit, was my several days trying to reach the source of the Onon River and back. It was wonderful, wild country. We changed kind of climates as well as terrain as we climbed up from the Mongolian steppe in fall. Still warm there on the steppe, but as we climbed up, it got colder, the rains came down, but stunningly beautiful. My knees were intensely sore after those days on horseback. So the rest of it seemed a doddle, but the rest was done by train, by jeep bucking across the steppes, and by various forms of boat transport, notably at the end, an old bone-shaking Soviet-era hydrofoil, which transported me as if on a magic carpet for the last 400 miles of this river's journey.
And you write about the flora and the fauna and the mosquitoes, and it sounds very fascinating.
The Soviets used to call the mosquitoes of the Amur fascists, and I could see why, having been feasted upon by them.
Well, what sort of feelings did you leave the region with?
I left with a sense of a region, the Russian Far East, that was emptying out and kind of sort of losing hope, as Putin, very far away in Moscow, seemed not, according to locals there, really to be thinking or caring about them. But what really impressed me was a kind of gruff warmth that comes from Siberians, a sense that they understand their place and they understand its beauty. And it was really that human warmth that most impressed me.
Well, the name of the book, Black Dragon River, A Journey Down the Amur River at the Borderlands of Empires. Thank you so much, Dominic.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
From our music library, VOA's Steve Norman takes a look at an up-and-coming new singer-songwriter.
You know, there is a growing number of younger performers out there making the music scene. Well, they're playing music and singing the songs from the Great American Songbook and many of the other pop, jazz, and rock tunes that have been big hits for decades. One of the bright, relatively new talents is multi-instrumentalist Kate Davis, known for playing the double bass.
I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key, 'cause I'm wise to all those tricks you played on me. I'm gonna turn my back on love, gonna snub the moon above, fill my windows up with tin so the lover can't get in. I'm gonna park my romance right along the curb, put a sign up on my heart, please don't disturb, 'cause if I never fall in love again, that's soon enough for me. I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key.
Billy Eaton and Terry Shan wrote, "I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key," for one of the greats of the jazz scene, Billie Holiday.
I said I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key, 'cause I'm wise to all those tricks you played on me. I said I'm gonna turn my back on love, gonna snub the moon above, fill my windows up with tin so the lover can't get in. I'm gonna park my romance right along the curb, put a sign up on my heart, please don't disturb, 'cause if I never fall in love again, that's soon enough for me. I'm gonna lock my heart, lock my heart. I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key.
Kate Davis was born in 1991 in West Lynn, Oregon. That's in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, and went on to play with the Portland Youth Philharmonic, becoming a presidential scholar in the arts, and studying at the Manhattan School of Music.
Imagine there's no heaven. easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion to.
Kate Davis on the keyboards this time, singing John Lennon's Imagine. Recently, Kate has shared the stage with such diverse artists as Alison Krauss, Josh Groban, Ben Folds, and Renee Fleming.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Vietnam, Syria, Russia, Iran, and other countries, journalists are under siege and freedom of expression is under threat. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in 2014, more than 60 journalists were killed, hundreds imprisoned, and dozens remain missing. Reporters Without Borders notes that governmental attempts to silence journalists include censorship, harassment, restrictive NGO laws, and public threats by political leaders. Speaking at Columbia University in New York, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Richard Stengel, himself a former journalist, described freedom of expression as a foundational human right. Challenges to that freedom, he said, are now deeper and more profound than at any time in decades. He described three: the physical dangers journalists confront in conflict zones and elsewhere, the shrinking space for free expression in countries with autocratic leadership, and the rise of disinformation. In the past, journalists trying to expose the truth were given a kind of safe pass, said Undersecretary Stengel. Now they are targets of regimes and of terrorists like ISIL. As such, supporting freedom of the press is a critical element of U.S. foreign policy. It is one of the issues that our diplomats around the world regularly address in bilateral talks with governments. One initiative provides trainings to journalists on physical and digital security and psychosocial care throughout the world. And the U.S. has invested over $100 million in internet freedom programs to provide tools and trainings to thousands of vulnerable civil society and independent journalists around the world. Finally, in response to the rise of disinformation from terrorist groups or autocratic regimes, the U.S. is being proactive, said Undersecretary Stengel, in claiming the space for truth-telling by pushing back on propaganda and falsehood with fact-based messages, as well as by supporting independent media around the world with financial, technical, and logistical support. And why? Because, as President Barack Obama has said, journalists give all of us as citizens the chance to know the truth about our countries, ourselves, our governments. That makes us better. It makes us stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.